Have you been wandering through life with no purpose? Are you looking for a catalyst to change your life for the better? These Servant Leadership podcasts will change your perspective of yourself, others, and your creator. This transformational leadership approach uses seven simple tools to help you understand your purpose in life. Please join Dave Kuhnert and Chris Seegers for today's podcast.
Servant Leadership Podcast number 6. Power and influence. Good afternoon, Chris.
How's it going, Dave?
Well, today, Chris, we're going to get into what it means to have all this power and influence to serve others. So this is our first real here tool. What we've been talking about up till now has been all about the there. It's been clarity of the there and how to get there and having a transcendent there. And then we talked about even when we have that there, we have another there that's always trying to keep us from getting to our transcendent there, the me there. So we have the we there and the me there. Then we talked about setting goals to help us get there. And now that we understand how to get there, and hopefully at this point, if you haven't already started contemplating what it means to have a transcendent there for your life, or for your marriage, or for your children, that you start getting that together to help give you that purpose-driven life, to help you take those steps to live life the way God intended us to live life. And with that, then, we have to know our here. And as we said in the first several podcasts, our here is all about current reality and knowing where we are, not just physically, but where we are mentally, emotionally, and spiritually in life. So now that we understand the there, we have to create and we know how to create the there. The next step is to understand the here. The here is just another word for current reality. And today, the first tool that we're going to talk about in our here is power and influence. So power and influence, when we look at that, we say, why do we want to have power with others? Why do we want to have influence with them? And it's all about serving them. When we know the type of power or influence we have with them, we can leverage that to open doors. So a lot of times power can be this dirty word for some folks. You know, I have power over you. Well, it's true. You have some sort of power, but it's all in the eye of the beholder. It's all in perception. So if I believe you have some type of power or influence with me, you do. If I look at you in a position of authority or power and influence, you have that position power with me. So we want to be able to influence others to get there, as our definition of leadership, servant leadership up till now, has been all about influencing others to get there. So to be able to do that, well, we have to have influence to do it. Chris, let me start by just asking, who was your role model growing up? Who did you really look up to?
The answer you're supposed to give is Jesus, right?
That's the Sunday school answer.
Yeah, that's the Sunday school answer. But I think I told you when I was a kid, I looked up to John Wayne. He had this charisma and presence, and I think you told me that that was the wrong answer, so so now I'm looking for the right answer.
When we look at who our role model was when we were younger, or even now, we probably had someone in there that we wanted to model our lives after, or some part of our life after. And even now, as we look around, we have folks that we rely on for that more than we do others. Sometimes it's a hybrid of many folks that we kind of put in some aggregate pool that we take different attributes from to try to model our lives after. And just looking at a study here, Chris, Stephen White and Joseph O'Brien, they did a survey with kindergarten through 12th graders in eastern Kansas. For the kindergartners and through third grade, they gave them a verbal test, and then the older students, they actually gave a written test to. And they asked them just a couple questions. They asked them, what is a role model, first of all? And then the second question was, who your personal role model was or is, and were they a positive influence in your life? So the question number one was, what is a role model? And overall, the responses to that question fell into three categories. The majority of the students gave definitions that were pretty general, such as, a role model is someone to look up to or someone you want to be like. The second most popular response described a role model as someone who sets an example or does good things. And the third category consisted of responses such as someone who inspires you or teaches you and helps you. While related, all three of these categories seem distinct in their different answers. Question number two was, who are your personal role model or these influential people in your lives? parents or family members were identified first. That was number one, which is probably a good thing. So when you're younger, generally the boys looked up to their father, and that was the role model that they had, and girls was the mother. Second was teachers. So if you're a teacher out there, don't underestimate the influence that you have in the lives of children. More so than anyone else, other than parents, teachers were in second place. Third came popular sports figures or actors and musicians. The remaining of the answers, which totaled up to less than 8%, were responses such as God, Martin Luther King Jr., or they said themselves as a role model.
Which, that's your role model, right?
Yeah.
Dave Coonert is Dave Coonert's role
that's,
model.
That should be your role model, Chris, but you chose John Wayne. We're going to have to work on that.
That was before I knew you, Dave. Now it's you.
So we want to influence others to get down the path of life, and understanding that, especially if you're a parent, the type of influence that you can have with your child, and hopefully you do, is really important, and you can leverage that to serve them. Or if you're a teacher or a coach, that you have a lot of influence with those students out there to be able to influence their lives. And I can't tell you how many classes I've taught where I ask who your role model was when you were little, and it's either a parent, a grandparent, a teacher, or a coach. And I think it's just awesome if we recognize that there are five types of this, different types of power that we have. And as a parent or a teacher or a coach, we can leverage them to help others.
And I think, too, role models, looking back, really the role models in my life were my grandparents and my parents. But I think depending on their lot in life and what they do well, they may be a good example in some areas and not, right? The good example is when they're emulating God. The bad example is when they're not, right? The we there versus the me there. So I think there's also a lot of kind of selective role model emulation where you're like, hey, they do a great job maybe in their career, but maybe not as good with family or vice versa and that sort of thing. So you can kind of, you know, look at the positives and, you know, not emulate the negative sides.
It's probably a good thing you threw your parents in there, Chris. They might actually listen to this podcast.
Yeah, absolutely. Love you, Mom.
My first role model, of course, just like you, mine was my dad growing up initially. And then when I joined the Army, it became my drill sergeant. My drill sergeant seemed to embody everything I wanted to be as I entered the military. They were physically fit. They seemed to know everything. And they were just in a position that I could only hope to attain at some point in my life. And it was pretty amazing the leverage and influence that they had over you, the power that they had over what you did every day. And all of that to be said, again, we there's five types of power. We don't want to use this to try to control others. We want to use power not to manipulate others, but to influence them and to serve them.
Do you want to just list all five off and we'll go through them and list them again just so people have it in their head?
That'd be great. Yeah, so the first type of power or influence is position power. The second is coercive. The third, reward. The fourth is expert power. And the fifth and most influential is referent power. So let's start with position power. So Chris, when you think of position power, what do you generally think of?
I usually think of police, the police.
Yeah, police officers would have a lot of position power. So position power is simply influence that you have based on a position you may have. If you're a police officer, for most of us, you have position power. Now, unfortunately, we've seen in our society or lack thereof that we tend to have some people that do not give police the respect that they're due. They don't have that type of power. So again, power or influence is in the eye of the beholder. If I don't believe a police officer has power over me, then they don't have that power. Same as a firefighter or anybody in a uniform, typically, when the firefighter busts in the door and tells you, hey, you need to exit the building, it's on fire, we probably don't do a lot of questioning. We just exit the building. This would be true for elected officials or for managers. If you're a manager or you supervise others in any capacity, even as a parent or a teacher or a coach, you have some position power. You have some power to do some things for those people or to take things away just based on your position. The second type of power is coercive power, and this is tied closely to position power. You don't necessarily have to have position power to have this, but this gets a bad rap, coercive power, because coercive power is the power to take away or the power to punish. And that sounds terrible. But in reality, is something as a parent we use all the time.
Yeah, absolutely. And we've got a 9-month-old son, and you know, he's too young to spank or really understand, but we've started having to use this because we've got a couple lamps that he pulls them over and he pulls them onto himself, right? So it's our responsibility of parents to say, hey, we want to make sure that our son is safe, so we're going to intervene and use our coercive power to make sure that that doesn't happen.
Yeah, I mean, it's all about safety in that regard. And so sometimes we have to do what's in their best interest. You're serving him.
Punishing or taking away something.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's actually helping him understand boundaries. So for the child, that's especially important. But if you look at somebody as a manager or as a leader, and they have the power to take something away from you or punish you, take away your job or your position or maybe some money, they have coercive power with you. This one is typically overused by new leaders. New leaders tend to really rely on coercive power way too much and not see that sometimes there's a better approach.
Why do you think that is, Dave?
I think it's lack of security. I think they kind of feel like insecure in their position. And when we tend to feel insecure, we tend to let that ego swell a little bit. We tend to get loud because we don't really know what we're doing. So this will result in that leader that yells a lot or the leader that threatens, everything's a threat. And when they do that, they actually lose their coercive power. When we tend to overuse the coercive power, it's like taking the beating, and pretty soon you just don't care anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So you can lose it by overusing it, and you can also lose it by not following through. If you tell little Johnny to clean his room, if you don't clean your room, you're going to get a whooping, and little Johnny doesn't clean his room, and he never gets the whooping, well, he starts to realize that that's an empty threat. It's hollow, and you lose that power with him very, very quickly. So we can overuse it and lose it, and we can also lose it by not following through. We can, however, gain more of it by following through, by doing what we say we're going to do. If little Johnny doesn't clean his room and we threaten the spanking and he doesn't do it, well, he gets a spanking. And as long as we're consistent and we continue to follow through, we'll continue to gain more influence through coerciveness. Not bad when used properly. Overused, just like anything else in life, too much of a good thing can be bad. The third type is reward power. Reward power is the exact opposite of coercive, but it's very similar. So this is the power that you have to give something or to reward something. Little Johnny, clean your room, you get a cookie. Well, just like coercive power, I can lose it by overusing it and by not following through.
A lot of people call these the carrot and the stick. And I think, you know, there's been a ton of research done on kids these days. I mean, specifically the millennials get a bad rap, but what's happened in a lot of cases, they got rewarded for everything, right? Hey, good job. You get a participation trophy instead of saying, hey, you didn't do a very good job. You need to work harder so that you can excel in this area. So it's been overused, I think, a lot in our society.
Yeah, it still does get overused a lot in many workplaces, as a matter of fact. You may feel even the need as a manager or supervisor to constantly tell people good job for things that they did okay at. So we just want to make sure that we actually give a compliment. We want it to be true, specific, and personal. Hey, Chris, really good job on that particular task.
You couldn't even think of one thing, Dave.
I know, it's kind of tough. So we want to make sure that we're giving praise for praiseworthy things. We don't want to give praise for things that aren't praiseworthy. If they did an okay job, well, that's what it was. It was an okay job. So to gain reward power, praise the praiseworthy. Make sure it's specific and personal and true when we give those types of compliments. Otherwise, just as we said with the coercive example, we're going to lose that type of power. When you go around and tell everybody good job all the time, it doesn't mean anything anymore. So we want to make sure that we're doing it when it's deserved. And this is, again, another one where immature leaders can tend to overuse this one. Not as often as they do the coercive, but this would be the next most overused type of influence. So our fourth type of power, more influential probably than the other three, is expert power. And this one is something that you can achieve just by being that subject matter expert. When you think back to your first job or the job you're in now, and you first got there, there was somebody that had probably been there a long time, or somebody who everybody asked the questions of. If you're that person, you're the person everybody comes to ask questions and get feedback, you're that subject matter expert. You have a lot of expert power or influence with that group of people. So recognizing that I have that type of power, again, to influence them, not manipulate or control, but influence them towards the there for their lives and to do good in life. So this expert power, when we think to respect to leaders, there's really two types of leaders. There's formal and informal. A formal leader has position. So a formal leader would be a sergeant in the army, a manager at work, a parent can be a formal leader. And they rely, or they have a lot of position, coercive, and reward power. An informal leader doesn't have to be in a position. An informal leader can have a lot of expert power, or referent power, we'll talk about here in a minute. But it's usually the expert power is the person that everybody goes to answer those questions on the team.
Yeah, we had a guy growing up on my grandparents' ranch when we worked there, just a ranch hand, and he still actually works there. He's been there over, I don't know, 25 years, but he was the expert on everything. I mean, if you needed to learn how to weld, you go to this guy. If you need to learn how to rebuild a baler, you go to this guy. But he had no positional power. But if you had any issue, you went to this guy because he knew everything. He'd ranched his whole life. And it was pretty incredible. And I think we talk a lot about, you know, conveying power and growing your power through teaching. And he did that. You know, he didn't hammer you and say, man, you know, you're stupid for not knowing this. He would say, let me show you how to do this.
That's great. Yeah, it's tough to find those people in a lot of places, in a lot of environments. They're just not there because they're not allowed to grow that power. So we can grow our expert power. We can do that by being the subject matter expert. You could be your industry's leading expert, but if you don't demonstrate that expertise, you don't have expert power with people. People need to see that you're the expert for you to have that influence with them. So you wanna get it out there. You wanna show what you know. And that may be through teaching a class, reading up on a topic, becoming the subject matter expert, getting out there and sharing what you know with others. When you see someone struggling, hey, would you like to know more about that? I can help you. I've done this before. And just being participative and showing, just like that ranch hand you're talking about, and really just demonstrating that you're the expert in that particular field. So we can read up and become the professional that we want to be and look the part and act the part and get out there and give classes and build that expert power. We can do this for others as well. If you're a manager or a supervisor and you have someone out there that you'd like to build expert power in and help them be a better influence over others, have them get up and teach a class. But you want to make sure they're rehearsed. You don't want them to get out there and do a poor job at it, because then they're going to give that expert power away. So you want to make sure that you've rehearsed it and that they're prepared and that they do a good job with it. And once you do that, as a manager, you have that other person, that other employee that reports to you, give that class. All of a sudden, all of the questions that were getting asked to you now get asked of that person. You've just freed up a bunch of your time. You just made it a whole lot easier for you to get other things done that might be more important. And now that guy or that gal has the ability to influence others where you had to do it all by yourself before. So you're developing leaders. And really, to be an expert at something, you hear this 10,000 hours remark all the time, that it takes 10,000 focused hours to become an expert in something. In other words, if you are a pianist and you wanted to be an expert piano player, it would take you 10,000 focused hours once you've learned the basics. That's a lot of time. That's a lot of effort to put into something. So to become an expert at something is going to take a whole bunch of focused effort, whatever your job is.
It looks like about 5 years if you're working 40 hours a week, 50, you know, if you have a couple weeks of vacation. I mean, that's a tremendous amount of time.
And that's if you're making widgets, you're doing one task all day long, 40 hours a week. So generally, it takes a career. Regardless, that's to be the consummate professional expert in that field, you're still probably further down the road than someone else is towards that 10,000 hours. So you're going to have some level of expert power with people that maybe have 20 hours or are newer to it than you are.
That's a good point.
So you can still have expert power without having logged all 10,000 hours. But once you have those 10,000 hours, you're really looked at as an industry leader. So putting in the time and making it focused time, focused effort, will help you gain that expert power. The final type of power is referent power. This is the most influential type of power. This is the type of power that comes from just from doing life right. You know, when you're out there at the grocery store, or people get to know you and then they just ask that question, hey, there's something different about you. What is it that's different about you? Well, it comes from that inner light that we talked about with those resume versus the eulogy values. When you start to have those eulogy virtues and they start to shine through and that inner light starts to radiate, people see that you're doing life differently. When you start doing life differently and you start acting like that role model, what's different about you? I want to be like you. Remember the old commercials, Michael Jordan commercials from the 80s and 90s that I want to be like Mike? That's what this is. You looked at Michael Jordan as a role model. This is doing life the way God intended us to.
And I think there's been a lot of great examples of that here in our industry that actually blew me away. I mean, I come from a more secular state than Texas, I think, a little bit more liberal. And I think the referent power demonstrated is selflessness, right? There's a lot of great, you know, CEOs, leaders of the industry that when we moved out here, were giving of their time to me. In Denver, that never happened. You're never getting a CEO's time to talk through industry issues or whatever. And out here, it was this referent power of you see them doing life right, and all of a sudden that inspires you to say, you know, I can give my time to somebody else. I don't have to be a CEO, but it was pretty incredible, I think.
Yeah, if you're listening to this right now and you think back to who your role model was when you were young, that person probably had a lot of referent power with you. They probably had that because of how they did life. And if you were to describe what it is about them that gave them that influence with you, I bet it would fall into one of those pillars that we talked about before. We're going to call them the tenets of referent power. We talked about this in goal setting, and I'm going to describe it again. As we know, we need to hear things 7 to 11 times to finally get it. I think I've said, actually, that 7 to 11 times thing about 7 to 11 times now, so we should be getting close on that one.
Nice.
But if you think about that building with the six pillars that kind of supports you, that holds you up, the foundation for that building are your values. And each one of those pillars rests on that foundation. And again, the wise man builds his house upon the rock. The foolish man builds his house upon the sand. So if your values are strong and you know what you value, part of your current reality, what do I value? Not what should I value, but what do I value? And understanding the reality of that, current reality. Most people, if you ask them what they value, they're going to say honesty, integrity, loyalty, duty, selfless service, some good values like that. Well, that's what they should value, and that's what they recognize, but that's not necessarily what they do value. The current reality of it is, where do I spend my time, and where do I spend my money? What am I actually doing to know what I value? Maybe it's video games. Maybe it's pornography. Maybe it's alcohol or drugs or doing things I shouldn't be doing. Not what I should value, but what I actually value. That's the foundation for your building, Chris. What do I actually value? Then we have our six pillars that sit on top of that particular structure on that foundation. These six pillars are really important. The first pillar that we see is the physical pillar. So we said that the physical pillars, when you first meet someone, in the first 2/10 of a second, you've kind of already determined whether they're good looking or they have a strong physical presence about them. They look professional. They're showing up on time. Are they working hard? They have a lot of work ethic. We kind of look at that and say, okay, you have a strong physical pillar. Or if you have a physical ailment, you might have a weaker pillar. The second pillar that we had there was the social pillar. After you meet them and they start to have a conversation with you, you learn very quickly if they're introverted or extroverted. Not that either one is bad, but what kind of a social safety net do they have? What kind of a social network do they have to help them in times of adversity? Do they have people that are just on Facebook? maybe Instagram or other social media, or do they have deep, meaningful relationships with the people around them? The third pillar that holds us up is our mental and emotional pillar. This is your EQ and your IQ, your intelligence quotient and your emotional quotient. Are they well-read? Are they smart? Are they in control of their emotions? Or do their emotions control them? Are they someone who is always responding to emotions? People like this, you typically have to walk on eggshells around for fear of upsetting them. People who have strong control of their emotions, you don't ever have to worry about that with, because you know they're going to be calm, cool, and collective.
And I don't think people realize how crippling that is, right? I mean, when you're in a situation, and I was actually talking about this over lunch with a gentleman that he was referencing a guy that basically gets bored during meetings. And so when he gets bored, he leaves because he's at an executive level. And he's like, man, so we're constantly having to apologize for this guy. Well, it's because he doesn't control his emotions. He doesn't control the fact that even though, you know, there's times in life that you're bored, you still have to control that. And so I think it can be crippling, and not many people see that as a pillar, as something, hey, that, you know, I don't want to fly off the handle. I don't want to react poorly. I don't want to get bored and walk out. You know, I want to have control of that emotion.
Yeah, so somebody like that is really all about the me there. They're serving themselves, right? Instead of sticking it out and then talking to them and serving the team, helping them find better ways to present the material, helping them to better themselves and what they're doing instead of making life about me. I'm just going to be upset and I'm going to walk out of the room. That's a very immature, emotionally immature response. Absolutely right. Well, our fourth pillar is the family or team pillar. And this pillar is all about how you treat the people around you. Do you demonstrate respect to them? Do you serve your spouse and your children? Or do you expect to be served? Are you in that position? You know, the gentleman you're just talking about was probably had a weak team pillar. It wasn't about serving them. He was about serving me. The next pillar is the spiritual pillar. This one, for most people that will listen to a podcast like this, is pretty self-explanatory. We know the foundation for what we build upon with the Master Builder is Christ and the foundation of Christ. But we build on that foundation. And this pillar is about building on the foundation of Christ. Do I have a good relationship with my Creator or don't I? This is where we really, am I focusing on serving God, or am I remembering that, thinking about God not being a part of my life? Do I put him in the forefront all the time?
This is one, I've kind of mentioned this before. My wife and I use these pillars to set kind of milestones, quarterly milestones each year. And we used to do it annually. It was too far out, so we started doing it quarterly. But the spiritual one, that it's a convicting one. And one of the areas that myself and some of the other people that I journey with was convicted on is, hey, you know, we're servants of God, but how do we understand God? Well, by getting in the Word. Well, how well versed are we in His Word? Well, not as well as we should be. Okay, well, what does that lead to? Well, we need to really dive into the Word in our Bible study in the mornings. And so that was one of kind of the milestones, the goals that we put on our spiritual pillar is, okay, we're going to really dive into the Word, and here, you know, here's the study program and that sort of thing. Because it affects every other pillar in your life.
It absolutely does, yeah. Our final pillar here is the financial pillar, another big one, right? I mean, this one is very important to a lot of people, but you don't find out about it until probably last after you meet someone. And managing our money is biblical. Being a good steward of God's finances and God's possessions here on earth is very biblical. When we manage our money well and have a strong financial pillar, then when emergencies happen, we're prepared for it. We can handle a physical ailment and a crack in our physical pillar, or a problem with our family pillar. Someone in our family is sick, whatever it may be. If we have an emergency fund, well, we're prepared for emergencies. And this just comes down to, with my money, do I have money left at the end of the month? Or do I have month left at the end of my money? Am I saving money? Am I prepared for financial adversity to hit? And really, all of these pillars, they help us prepare for adversity. That's really what they are. They're a comprehensive fitness tool to help us face adversity and overcome. When we put energy into each of our pillars and into our values, we're actually making them stronger. So part of our current reality, and all of this makes up referent power, but part of our current reality is understanding which of my pillars are my strongest and which are my weakest. And I know the physical pillar is the greatest example of this, that if I'm not putting energy in, energy is leaving. If I do a total muscle failure workout today, it's going to take 48 hours to recover from that workout. After 72 hours, I'm completely recovered. But then at the 96-hour mark, my muscle starts to atrophy because it's not getting used. I have got to constantly be putting energy into that, my physical pillar, or it's going to start to atrophy. That's no different than with your social relationships. If you're not putting energy into your relationships, they're going to start to atrophy. If you're not managing your money and telling your dollar where to go, it's going to just go. If I'm not putting energy into my spiritual pillar, it's going to get weaker. If I'm not putting energy into my values, they're going to suffer from what we call entropy. The second law of thermodynamics is the law of entropy. It's from order to chaos. Everything goes through corrosion or into disorder, goes into falling apart if we're not putting energy into it.
And if you don't have the transcendent there to guide all your pillars, you go into that oscillation phase that we talked about previously, where I may just decide, you know what, my physical pillar is not as good as it should be, so all I'm going to focus on is that. Well, then you start oscillating because I realize, shoot, I'm not spending time with my wife and my son. Okay, I need to go to the family team pillar instead of saying, no, our transcendent there, which is pursue God and love others, that guides all of these actions. So if I focus on that, then I can figure out how to allocate my time between, you know, what's needed most.
Yeah, so this referent power is really important. And again, it's about being that role model for others, not just in good times. So when adversity strikes, you can show what it means to overcome adversity. This is about resiliency in the face of adversity, not if it happens, but when it happens. If I have good values, that's a great foundation. And I can build on that my physical pillar. If I'm in good physical condition, the mental and emotional benefits to that and the physical benefits, everybody knows about those. We don't have to get into that here. But it's how important that is to be able to overcome injuries or to deal with stress. And if I have good, deep, meaningful social relationships, my second pillar, how important it's going to be to have some people with me that will help me through this. And mental and emotional pillar, just being emotionally strong and mentally tough to overcome some of these challenges that I might face. Then our spiritual pillar and our family and team pillar, and how important those are in all of that, having that relationship with God to sustain me. And finally, my financial pillar, where I've got an emergency fund and I'm prepared for something to happen. So if tomorrow I find out, God forbid, I have cancer, a great physical ailment that we all fear, that's going to affect everything. That's going to affect all my pillars. And I can look at it, and I can actually strengthen my spiritual pillar through my difficult time with cancer. I can do better with it. Or I can let it affect me and let all my pillars start to crack and crumble. But to have referent power, when adversity strikes, we can demonstrate resiliency. That's what people see. You get knocked down, it's not about that. It's about how you get back up. And when we have strong pillars and good values, we get back up quicker. And we demonstrate what life is all about, the way God intended us to live it, and how to overcome and trust and have faith in Him. And people want to be like that. It opens doors of influence. It opens referent power.
So do you think people with referent power have a good balance on all these pillars?
Most of them do. Now, sometimes what we do is we see that physical pillar and we infer all the others. Oh, I saw Peyton Manning or Michael Jordan or whoever that sports figure is, and that physical pillar is so strong that we just infer all the other pillars. When in reality, what is it, 70% of NFL players go bankrupt, or 76% of NBA, something like that? They go bankrupt. They're not managing their money well. But we wouldn't know that. They make millions of dollars a year. Statistically, a financial disaster. Potentially spiritually as well. We don't know. But we can see the financial part because they claim bankruptcy. And really, it's just one strong pillar. We infer the rest. We give them credit for something that they haven't demonstrated necessarily. But when you have the ability to demonstrate all of these pillars as being strong through good values, it really makes a difference, and you're really able to influence others in a way that maybe wasn't available before you were able to demonstrate that. So if you look at Scripture, we can see this very clearly with Job 1 and 2. When you look at Job and what Job went through, it says right here, and the man was blameless and upright, and one who feared God and shunned evil. And 7 sons and 3 daughters were born to him. Also his possessions were 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, 500 female donkeys, and a very large household, so that this man was the greatest of all the people of the East. And his sons would go and feast in their houses each on his appointed day, and would send an invite to their 3 sisters to eat and drink with them. So it was, when the days of feasting had run their course, that Job would send and sanctify them, and he would rise early in the morning and offer burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For Job said, "It may be that my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts." Thus Job did regularly. Now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them. And the Lord said to Satan, "From where do you come?" So Satan answered the Lord and said, "From going to and fro on the earth, and from walking back and forth on it." Then the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, one who fears God and shuns evil?" Can you just imagine that? "Consider my servant Chris." Pretty awesome. So Satan answered the Lord and said, "Does Job fear God for nothing? Have you not made a hedge around him, around his household, and around all that he has on every side? You have blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. But now stretch out your hand and touch all that he has, and he will surely curse you to your face." And the Lord said to Satan, "Behold, all that he has is in your power. Only do not lay a hand on his person." So Satan went out from his presence of the Lord. Now there was a day when his sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house, and a messenger came to Job and said, "The oxen were plowing and the donkeys feeding beside them when the Sabaeans raided them and took them away. Indeed, they have killed the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you." While he was still speaking, another also came and said, "The fire of God fell from heaven and burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them, and I alone have escaped to tell you." While he was still speaking, another also came and said, "The Chaldeans formed 3 bands, raided the camels and took them away. Yes, and killed the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you." And while he was still speaking, another came and said, "Your sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in the oldest brother's house, and suddenly a great wind came from across the wilderness and struck the 4 corners of the house, and it fell on the young people, and they are dead. And I alone have escaped to tell you." Then Job arose, tore his robe, and shaved his head, and he fell to the ground in worship, and he said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return there. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." In all this, Job did not sin, nor charge God with wrong. There was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan was among them to present himself to the Lord. And the Lord said to Satan, "From where do you come?" Satan answered the Lord and said, "From going to and fro on the earth, and from walking back and forth on it." Then the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and shuns evil? And still he holds fast to his integrity, although you incited me against him to destroy him without cause." So Satan answered the Lord and said, "Skin for skin, yes, all the man has he will give for his life. But stretch out your hand now and touch his bone and his flesh, and he will surely curse you to your face." And the Lord said to Satan, "Behold, he is in your hand, but spare his life." So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and struck Job with painful boils from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. And he took for himself a potsherd with which to scrape himself while he sat in the midst of the ashes. Then his wife said to him, "Do you still hold fast to your integrity? Curse God and die." But he said to her, "You speak as one of the foolish women speaks. Shall we indeed accept good from God, and shall we not accept adversity?" In all this, Job did not sin with his lips. Now when Job's 3 friends heard of all this adversity that he had come upon, Each one came from his own place. Eliphaz, Temanite, Bildad, the Shuhite, and Zophar, the Naamite. For they had made an appointment together to come and mourn with him and to comfort him. And when they raised their eyes from far and did not recognize him, they lifted their voices and wept. And each one tore his robe and sprinkled dust on his head toward heaven. So they sat down with him on the ground 7 days and nights, and no one spoke a word to him, for they saw that his grief was very great. So this whole passage is about facing adversity. Now, I don't know too many people that have gone through what Job did and still sustain their spiritual pillar, still retain their values and the one pillar he had left. Because look, what did he lose? His physical pillar, completely shattered, right? Boils from head to toe. His social pillar, his friends would go on throughout this particular verse, and they would turn against him and tell him, hey, just repent your sins. But Job hadn't sinned, so he said, no, I can't repent for a sin I did not do. And they tried to turn him into a transactional component with God. And then we saw the same thing with his family, all destroyed, killed. And also with his finances, the richest man in the land, everything he had was taken from him. The only thing he really had to sustain him was his spiritual pillar, even mentally and emotionally anguished. And his spiritual pillar sustained him. So Job is the perfect example of how to do this right, how to overcome adversity, how to be resilient in the face of the storm.
And we've talked about that before. If your spiritual pillar is strong, you can get through anything. One of the speaker series we had recently, I believe you were there, there was a gentleman that was talking about his battle with cancer that he had won. And he said, you know, I wouldn't trade that for the world, because that battle with cancer is what brought me closer to Christ, right? So his spiritual pillar strengthened, and even as his physical pillar and probably financial pillars were crumbling, the spiritual pillar sustained him.
It's pretty amazing when someone can go through that level of adversity and come out stronger through that fiery trial on the other side because of their relationship with God. And there's something different about him, right? That's what you look at and you say, there's something different about him. I want to be like him. That person has now a tremendous amount of influence with you, has now opened doors to share Christ, to help them towards their there, to influence them to get there. Let's take a look at this from a historical perspective. So we saw how Job dealt with it, and this has happened throughout history as well. The Nuremberg Address, not a very well-known historical moment in time. This happened in Newburgh, New York. This is in March of 1783. The Revolutionary War was all but over. The last of the British forces were about to leave America, and they would in September of that year. So all that's left to do is sign a few more documents. The fighting's all but over. Many of the senior officers at this time, though, were really disgruntled with the Continental Congress. They had not received their pay, their back pay, or their pensions that they had been promised. And this all came to a head on the 10th of March of 1783 in Newburgh, New York. The officers decided that they're going to meet to determine how they would march the army out into the frontier and give the country back to the British. They scheduled a meeting for the 10th of March. So General Washington heard about the scheduled meeting and ordered it postponed to the 15th of March. He spent the next 5 days speaking with friends, searching for advice, praying to God to give him strength and wisdom, and writing the most impassioned speech he could come up with. He also received a speech from a congressman, Joseph Jones. Well, the officers began their meeting on the 15th of March, and they all agreed that the Continental Congress had wronged them. They had not followed through on their promises, and it was time to turn everything back over to the King of England. Unnoticed, Washington slides in the side door and, upon hearing his disgruntled men, decides to move to the front of the room and read his speech. General Washington gave his very impassioned speech, but it met with a great deal of resistance. He talked about loyalty, duty, and honor, to which the officers very vocally stated that Congress had no such honor or no such loyalty, so why should they? Washington's entire speech had fallen flat, and he knew it was over. Everything they had fought for was coming to an end. He was defeated. So Washington had promised Congressman Jones that he would read that speech that Jones had written. So defeated, Washington pulls the speech from his pocket and began to read. He stumbled over the first few words and He was very emotional and couldn't read them without his spectacles. So he pulled the spectacles from his pocket and he said, "Gentlemen, you'll have to forgive me. I've grown gray in your service and now find myself growing blind." The incident was so moving and powerful that many of the men openly wept. The man who they all wanted to be like and had suffered through every hardship with was not quitting on them. He was still loyal to the cause and had sacrificed as much, if not more, than any of them. He was still committed to the there. Just like that, the insurrection had ended. They realized there was something greater than themselves at stake. Through George Washington's act of humility and frailty, they were able to see the we there and were ashamed to have walked towards the me there. The next day, the officers gathered again, and this time it was just to sign a petition commending George Washington for service and loyalty to the country. See, George Washington had a tremendous amount of reverent power over his men. He was the man they all aspired to be. He was physically imposing at over 6 feet tall. The average height for a man back then was about 5'6". So he had that physical pillar through his physical size, and he looked the part of the commander-in-chief. He was always on time and was a veteran who had fought many battles in the French and Indian War. George Washington had great social skills. His social pillar was very strong. He was known for his interpersonal skills and ability to communicate well. He treated others with dignity and respect, so he would have had a strong family team pillar. He was very intelligent and strong control of his emotions, so he would have had a strong mental and emotional pillar. George Washington was also known for being a pious man. We've all seen the painting of him kneeling next to his horse and praying in the moonlight. So he would have had a strong spiritual pillar. He was also very wealthy. He had all of his pillars in order and had a great foundation for values. He used all of this to influence others on numerous occasions in order to keep our country alive. Really, George Washington, when he pulled out those spectacles and put them on and just told, "I've grown old and gray in your service and I've also grown blind," the man they all wanted to be, the man they all respected more than anyone else in their lives, was still there and still committed. They probably all felt a little embarrassed and ashamed that they had left the we there, the goal, the purpose that he was still committed to, and has shifted towards serving me and what's in it for me.
So we've got some good historical role models, one in Job, one in George Washington, and just seeing them demonstrate their strength in those pillars. And like you said, what's referent power? It's living life right and understanding that and seeing that.
So we have our five types of power. The first is position power. It's about just having a position and some influence. The second was coercive, and that's about the power to take something away or the power to punish. The third was reward, which is the ability to give something. The fourth was expert power. It's being that subject matter expert. It's demonstrating that you are the leading expert in what you do. And the fifth, of course, referent power. And that referent power all centers around how you do life. Do you do life the way God intended you to or not? And to do it the way God intended you to, we're talking about those pillars. The foundation to those pillars are your values. What do I value, not what should I value? Physical pillar, mental emotional pillar, social pillar, family team pillar, spiritual pillar, and financial pillar. Putting energy into those will help you gain referent power and will open a lot of doors to create a tremendous amount of opportunities for you to serve others, for you to serve God, for you to influence others to get there. So that ends this podcast on power or influence. What we're going to talk about in the next episode is leadership styles. So how do I take that power and influence, and how do I then apply it to others? How can I help them and influence them to get there?
If you would like to offer feedback to any of the Servant Leadership podcasts, please go to our Facebook page and click on the comment section. You can also check us out online at trueservantleadership.com. Our site will soon have videos for the tools that we recommend using, and we will be adding additional content to the website in the future, including links for these podcasts. All of our material comes from the book Servant Leadership, Influencing Others to Get There by Leading a Transformational Life. If you're interested in the book, You can find it at Amazon.com. Both the paperback and the electronic version are available for order. The electronic version is only $1.99, and all of the proceeds from the book go to charity. Thanks for listening, influencing others to get there, serving others, and most of all, thanks for leading with the example of a transformational life set by our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ.